Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to another episode of Trinoons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyon.
We did it.
Obviously not as strong as past Louisville teams, but I think a lot of us have been saying for weeks now, like, in this late stretch, there was no way SU was going to pull an upset, and lo and behold, here we are. Nice win over an actually ranked Louisville team that really needed to kind of bounce back, and now suddenly looks like they themselves are on some shaky ground. Not that they're not going to make the tournament, but I think their hopes as a 1-4 seed are definitely dwindling at the moment. But plenty of time to play their way back in.
For sure, it's not a great Louisville team. It's a worse Louisville team without Chris Jones. But it's still a team that has two all-ACC-type players, one of which, Montrezl Harrell, was, if you polled most college basketball fans, you'd probably say he's one of the best big men in the country. And Rakeem Chris has dominated him, like totally dominated him, which was really awesome. And I think for a couple of weeks now, it's like Syracuse has been close in every game. They've been playing very tough against teams that are pretty good, Duke, UNC, Pitt. Obviously, Kitsap plays with the other two. But it's just Syracuse hasn't been able to get over the hump. And today was very validating for those of us who believe that this team is a pretty solid team with just some major depth issues. It proved that SU, while it's not a great year by our standards, it's still a team that is dangerous, that could compete in the ACC this year and could have, potentially made some noise. It was a very gratifying win, I think.
Right. And interestingly, I know that over on Syracuse.com, Donna DeToto put together that article on Syracuse kind of fading in the second half the other day. And to see the exact opposite thing happen here was very, very welcome. Obviously, when Rack hits free throws and he's going to get that sort of dribble penetration that he did, it definitely helps. And having, more than a couple players, being effective. I mean, between him and Benajé and Roberson, usually if those three can put in a good game, or if you want to sub in Cooney with one of them, SU stands a chance against just about anybody. It was just great to see this team for once all season kind of close out. I mean, I haven't felt this good about a close this season since Virginia Tech was a comeback, not a close. I'd say Wake Forest was probably your best comparison in terms of, closing out a win that should have happened, in my book.
Yeah, not only do we get good games from those three, Cooney obviously didn't play well, but I thought Caleb made some really nice plays down the stretch. He had that nice little that little turnaround jumper in the lane, which put SU up six or so, sending the lead out. And then did he have a steal on the inbound pass pretty soon after that, too?
Yeah, I believe so.
So he played, not crazy numbers or anything, but he played, pretty big down the stretch when he's often been off the court. And then I thought Ron Patterson was all over the place in the first half on defense. Obviously, he is what he is offensively.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know if you saw Boeheim's post-game commentary, starting with Joseph saying, I think the quote was, it was a typical Boeheim quote, obviously, but Boeheim on Caleb Joseph shooting threes, there's no logical explanation for it other than you want to lose the game. his only Jim can put, you know, his aggravation with certain players taking certain shots. And just watch Jahlil Okafor definitely twist his ankle or something even worse. I don't know if you're also watching the Duke North Carolina game then.
Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, Dan,
I dropped. Yeah, I called in before I actually got to my apartment, so when I put the elevator up, I thought I'd be okay to hang on, but I got cut off like right as I was ending my sentence, I guess.
No worries. What was the last thing you heard?
I was just, as I got cut off, I was talking about how I thought Ron Patterson played with a pretty good effort tonight.
Oh. Well, then I had just mentioned Boeheim's quote, kind of blasting Caleb for taking a three. And then mentioned Jahlil Okafor's injury as I'm watching it in real time here on ESPN.
Yeah, I'm just turning that on now. I watched the end of the game and then got home about as quickly as possible, so I'm just kind of getting caught up with the rest of the basketball world here.
Well, this is your typical North Carolina Duke game. Okafor is coming back to the floor, so for those who are Knicks fans like me and are hoping to draft Okafor first overall, this definitely helps.
Yeah, you don't want to see guys like that get hurt, even if it's Duke. You want to see them go down in natural ways like last year in the NCAA tournament, not when they have a major injury.
Yeah, I mean, it's odd, too, with Duke. Is that I feel like I should hate them more now that we're in the same conference, and instead I hate them less, and I don't really get it. Is it just a respect thing, or is it something more? Is it that the conference collectivism that all of us kind of got driven towards during conference realignment? I'm not exactly sure.
I think a lot of it, I kind of feel the same way. Like, I don't root for Duke. I don't really know who I want to win this game, but I wouldn't say I actively root for them or anything, and I did thoroughly enjoy the NCAA tournament loss last year. But I feel like Boeheim and Kay's relationship kind of makes it hard to, like, totally hate them.
Fair.
Especially when we're in kind of a position where Syracuse can use high-profile, like, people defending them in terms of NCAA stuff and just the way the team plays this year. And Kay is almost always up for that for Boeheim, which is nice. So that makes it hard to, like, totally dislike them compared to, well, like, I'll never feel that way about Syracuse, or maybe not Georgetown or UConn or some of those other teams where we have a long-standing rivalry.
True. And, I mean, you never know. If 10, 15 years down the line, we still haven't played UConn again and us and Duke are battling it out for conference championships, and maybe things change, I mean. But for now, yeah, I'd say Duke serves a very good purpose as a bridge, but there's definitely much more to come in terms of our history with that team and what happens next, and especially with Georgetown back on the schedule and Louisville back after a one-year hiatus. It should be interesting, and I know that the rivalry – what was that, Dan?
I said those games, you know, back on the schedule, and then UConn's out there taking random pot shots on Twitter.
Yeah, you know what? Like, other than No Escalators, there are no UConn fans that I really tolerate on Twitter, just because everything that they say and do, and it's become, there are now two teams on top of Syracuse fans that cover Syracuse ad nauseum. And UConn has kind of joined the ranks of Georgetown fans in that regard.
It's been amazing because you'd think that a team with four national championships would not have little brother syndrome to a team that has won, but they totally do.
Yeah, that is an odd dynamic. And I think part of it is birthed from us having big brother syndrome despite having one championship.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a two-way street. But I don't know. It's a weird dynamic. I do kind of miss having them on the schedule, but I also, as a proud Connecticutter myself, I wouldn't mind if they fell off the face of the earth in terms of the basketball program. So I don't know if we need to lend them any relevancy as they go on with their Tulsas and their Houstons and their East Carolinas.
Or as it will now be referred, the Rump League. If, for those who missed that whole conversation that the New York Times referred to the American Athletic Association. American Athletic Conference as a Rump League, and I have heretofore been referring to the league as such. So if you want to hear what's going on in the Rump League on a weekly basis, follow the Rump League hashtag on Twitter.
Good times were had.
Oh, yeah. So I guess looking forward a little bit, you know, because I think the Louisville game, because it was a win, there isn't a ton to dig into and rehash. It's really just the simple things that we had pointed out before. Do you think this sets the stage for maybe not a win streak, but at least a very strong and confident team going into the Pitt game, which would be kind of their third straight home game?
Yeah, I think, well, A, this team should know that it can beat Pitt. Obviously, it was in it very late at the Pete, which is a tough place to play for anyone, as we saw with North Carolina this weekend. So the team should know that it can beat Pitt. Louisville is another one of the teams that we have kind of a long-standing history with, or longish standing, as far back as like the original Batista expansion goes. That used to give Syracuse a lot of trouble, and Syracuse beat them by 10. So if they can do that, and this Louisville team is ranked 12th right now at least, there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to go get split the two-game series with Pitt. And if they do that, then maybe hitting that 20-win plateau that Boeheim does so often becomes fairly manageable. They just have to win two of the last four. And obviously three of those games are against ranked teams, but, you know, it no longer becomes something that looks impossible.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I thought if we lost this game, I wouldn't even entertain the idea. But right now, I kind of have to side with you. 20 wins, if we beat Pitt especially, definitely looks like it's doable. I mean, it's not – I still don't think it's probable, if only because
– instead of being something that's like a big stretch – you know, you have to win one of the three ranked games and beat NC State at NC State, which isn't easy. I think NC State's a pretty good team when they're on their game. But it no longer, like, if they had lost to Louisville tonight, I don't think there'd be much of a shot. But I think this win could help galvanize the team and galvanize, I don't think, a word. And they can kind of believe in themselves, because I'm sure there was some doubt lingering there.
Fair. And, yeah, I definitely see that. I think the Duke game obviously looms largest, and I don't buy the talk about us and Duke potentially being the game day game on February 28th. I just think that seems pretty far-fetched, especially compared to, you know, the Arizona-Utah game that's the same night. But I think Notre Dame, not that they're bad, I think that there's just there's something about them that, you know, you and I and various others will never trust. I think UVA, we discussed too, like I'll entertain the idea of UVA, you know, being a team, but I'm still a little skeptical, and I think that we play the type of game that can really not beat them, but the type of game that, you know, both teams will look a little evenly matched throughout. And then, yeah, you know, State's just one of those games where things can happen on both sides. I think State is going to be well entrenched in the tournament at this point. But that said, you know, if SU is looking for win number 20, I could definitely see this team playing for some pride and beating the Wolfpack down there, especially when And I don't know why. I just feel like things get a little chippy with the fan base and with that team, and no matter what the sport, for some reason, despite very little history other than, you know, a few quips before Syracuse joined the ACC.
Yeah, I kind of agree. And going back to UVA, I still we talked about them last week at length a bit. I still think they're very good. I do think that they're vulnerable because right now they're not fully healthy and their offense is kind of a mess. And that doesn't, you know, their defense is still really good. And if we don't get big games out of Binajay and or Cooney, beating that pack line is going to be difficult. But I could see us pulling an upset there. I wouldn't bet on it, but if they're still, you know, not at full strength, it's, I don't know. I could see that happening. I could see any of these games being a win. At Cameron's probably the iffiest proposition, but if a team plays like it did tonight and does it down the stretch, it's, you know, not the craziest thing in the world.
Spot on. Yeah, I guess looking around basketball, what else are you kind of noticing? I think later on we can kind of jump into some more typical tournament talk, but what are some things you've noticed over the last week? What are some things, especially in the ACC, that you're seeing before the tournament? Is there a team? I mean, obviously Duke and Notre Dame and Virginia have done a very good job of separating themselves throughout the season, but what do you think you know, within the last couple of weeks, boiled down to, and which of those teams do you think is able to come out of the ACC, both in the regular season and then in the tournament, which is really when it matters the most in this conference?
I don't know. It's a tough one for me because I feel like in college basketball as a whole, I feel like there's no team that isn't flawed. Even Kentucky, I wouldn't be shocked if they end up running the table in the regular season and then drop in the Sweet 16 just because that offense is really not very dominant. The defense is so good, but if a team gets hot from outside, I could see them falling. But ACC-wise, I mean, out of the regular, the main players here, Duke has defense issues. They've lost some weird games. UNC is inconsistent. Notre Dame is Notre Dame, and the NCAA tournament is still the same event. So I don't think any of these teams are slam dunk. I don't love Louisville. Offensively and for a lot of reasons. And I think Patino before the game cast some doubt on Jones coming back, which would be a big shot to them. So I'd probably say Duke just because they have the pedigree would probably be the team I have the most faith in and because they can outscore pretty much anyone. I don't know. It's all about matchups, I think, and it'll be really interesting to see where these teams fall in terms of the bracket because I don't think there are any ACC teams that are slam dunks to make a run to the Final Four, but I don't think there are any, you know, are automatic guys either. It's a really, I don't know, it's a very interesting year in terms of college basketball in total. And obviously Kentucky is the one dominant team in the country, but even then, like, I don't think there are any teams nationwide that make me think that, you know, there's no chance they get bounced out early.
That's fair, and I think, you know, we touched on that last week, too. Like, even a team like Kentucky, I was on some calls today at work. Everyone seemed to be on the Kentucky bandwagon in terms of, you know, penciling their place into the Final Four, and I was very surprised, considering the teams that we've seen in the regular season, ourselves included, in recent years, kind of running roughshod over a schedule. It is shocking to see everyone, you know, completely and utterly buying in when this squad does have some issues, has had some close calls against some not that great teams. I mean, I'm not casting doubt. I think Kentucky will be there. But like you said, there are no locks this year. And I think in the ACC especially, there aren't any locks to really – take this tournament championship. I think that top three I mentioned are the most likely ones, but at the same time, there's just too much that can happen in a very short four-day tournament. Crazy things have occurred, as we've noticed, as other teams have noticed. I mean, even in the ACC, the last few years have been chalk and regularly is chalk in this conference. But at the same time, like a team like NC State or I think a few years back Maryland did it too, just kind of caught fire as one of the lower seeds and was able to get enough wins in that tournament to get themselves into the big dance. So I think if I was going to bet on it, I'd probably go with Duke so long as Okafor is healthy. But, you know, that said, again, the other two really wouldn't shock me in the least.
Yeah, and we do have to see what Virginia looks like once they get Anderson back. Obviously, they've been, you know, they beat Pitt pretty handily a couple nights ago, but Wake Forest probably should have beat them. NC State and Louisville both, you know, came within five the week before. So it hasn't been easy sledding since that Duke loss. But their defense is really good, and I don't think a lot of teams – I don't think any team in the country defends like they do. But, you know, it's still a tournament, as we've all seen time and time again. Literally anything can happen. And one guy gets hot and can send a great team home, and that's why, you know, both UVA and Kentucky are kind of similar profile teams. Kentucky is way more athletic in their different styles, but they both dominate on defense. But if you know a guy go crazy from outside, you know, Kentucky could easily have five losses right now, just and against a not a great SEC. So it's that's what makes the tournament great. That's why we all love it.
Agreed. All right, I think it's a good place for at least some halftime here. Why don't we swing it to some beer? What have you been drinking lately, Dan?
During the game, I was actually – I watched the second half at a bar over in Hoboken where I work. I have to find the name. I tried Brooklyn's Dry Irish Stout, which I don't usually drink stouts generally. I mean, I'll try them once in a while, but they're not really my favorite type of beer. But this was really good. It was really, you know – it wasn't overly heavy, or it didn't, like, linger too long. Really nice finish, good solid flavor. So, you know, sometimes stouts I feel like are a little – they're a little too heavy-handed in terms of, you know, the aftertaste and whatnot. This one was really nice. Not crazy ABV, only 4.7. But just a good solid drink and definitely something I'd have again. Let me see what else I've had since. Oh, I was in Charlotte over the weekend, so I got to try or you know have some southern type stuff. I had Red Oak Amber, which is just a really solid Vienna lager. Nothing too crazy, but Red Oak got a couple things down there. Very solid brewery, and then not a North Carolina beer, but something you can't find up here too often. I had Sweetwater's 420 Extra Pale, which I've had before. Just a really nice pale ale, pretty hoppy, but full, really good citrus flavor and a nice hop finish. So I always like that one. It's when I get down to the Carolinas or Georgia.
Nice. On this end, a lot of people have probably seen these six packs around, but Sierra Nevada's Beer Camp Hoppy Lager. Very, very good stuff. I might actually go buy a 12-er after this just because most of the time I have all these trade acquisitions, all this other crap sitting around the fridge, and I never really want to share with anybody when they come over. So having something like that's always good. And again, really, really crisp, really enjoyable IPL style. We don't really get Brooklyn Brewery here at all in California, but I was in Vegas over the weekend, and they had a Brooklyn Blast on tap, so got to enjoy some of that, as well as some Tahoe Mountain Brewing Hop Song IPA while I was watching Syracuse lose to Duke in the sports books and tearing up my $20 ticket. Would have been nice, though, but these things happen. Also got to enjoy Hardywood Park Bourbon Gingerbread Stout. Really, really nice. I feel like the bourbon was definitely there, but it wasn't as heavy-handed as, say, some of the other bourbon barrel-aged stuff that I've drank. So it's not really an easy one to procure, but it's definitely one you should check out if you can find it. And then I also had the brewery's new Belgian Pale Ale, Jardinier, just French for gardener. you know, their fancy pants brewery. So I don't know where this one ends up on shelves back east, if at all. But again, the mildest thing you're going to drink from the brewery, but still plenty of flavor. Just a nice departure from their typical $15 a bottle, 9%, like Belgian strong ales, and it was more in the $5.99 and 4.9% range.
Yeah, the couple of things you've sent me from there, really good. I don't know if I've seen anything from them out here, so I think it's pretty hard to just do your hands on otherwise.
Yeah, I think I know that they don't really get down in the city much, but I think they're upstate. Yeah, because I know I've talked to some people that they get the brewery stuff up there. But, you know, if you're ever looking for anything, I'm happy to provide, because I do really, really enjoy their stuff pretty much top to bottom. And despite a very crowded tasting room, I'll definitely be in there at least once a quarter.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I had to tip back down to Brooklyn Brewery. I was there like one of the weekend before I moved to the city or that first weekend, and that was a really, really good spot. I also want to check out some of the other. I know Bronx Brewing is starting to gain a pretty decent foothold, so I would just over to them and check out some of the other ones around here.
Yeah, I know. I know Grimm is in Brooklyn, as is the Other Room. Have you been there? I know Aaron Goldfarb sent me some growlers from there last year.
Nice. Yeah, I'll
very,
check that out.
Very enjoyable. So yeah, that leads to, it's not really a segue, but football. Figured why not? We got spring practice starting, actually a week from right now. So Dan, I guess, what are some big storylines? We're going to go through a lot more of these on the site, kind of week by week as we go. It's previewing spring practice as well as through spring practice. But what are your big focuses? And yes, I know the word's supposed to be foci. What are the big things that you want to hone in on, I guess, going into spring practice?
Well, the obvious one is figuring out what the Tim Lester offense is. Obviously, there's people can tell you what they envision for their offense all the time. When Doug Marrone took the job, he said how he wanted to run like a billion plays and be up-tempo, and then we weren't that very much of at all of his tenure. But so Lester, you know, we hear about the 12 packages and you know how he wants to get back to more power running, but it's hard to really envision what a new offense is until you actually see it on the field. So that's like the big overarching question. And hopefully we get some decent insight from the spring. Obviously, I don't think practice will be open, but hopefully the Syracuse.com guys can get us some good insight on that. More specifically, I'm very worried about the left tackle position. Over the last couple of years, we've been kind of spoiled in having two legit NFL guys. Obviously, Justin Pugh was a first-round pick. Sean Hickey probably won't be as high, but, you know, he could be, depending on how well he does in the combine, which he should do really well considering what we've heard from his weight room acumen before. He'll probably be a mid-round pick right after Pugh, so we don't have that kind of heir apparent there. And so I'm a little concerned about that, especially with, you know, very big questions at quarterback. Obviously, it sounds like Terrell Hunt's going to have the job, but he didn't exactly light the world on fire last year. And then on the defense, you know, there's some pretty big holes. Linebacker lost Cam Lynch, lost Dyshon. We have Darrell Estridge in the secondary. Defensive line, still young. We don't have a breakout pass rusher, although there's some talent there with Ron Thompson and a few other guys. So, I'm not as worried about the defense just because Schaefer has put together and Bullitt too have put together such good defenses while they've both been here. But offensively, obviously, is where the concern is. As anyone who watched the team last year can tell you. And it'll be really interesting to see how the team morphs from last season, because it really can't be much worse.
Yeah, that's something I think a lot of us can attest to, me in particular, someone who decided to relive the nightmare every Monday night.
You, the person who watched 24 Syracuse games last year.
And honestly, I wish it could have been 26, but these things happen. I think you definitely hit on the one thing that really, well, two things, but the major thing that I need an answer on early, and I don't need just coach speak either, is somebody's got to tell me, and not just tell me, but show me what this offense is going to look like. I had some major issues with the offense, obviously, last year, as did everybody else. It was a deplorable group that couldn't execute in the red zone, couldn't really get the ball into the end zone in general, and never really understood its identity. And I think that was its biggest issue, is that it was kind of flailing around in the dark, trying to grasp what it wanted to be, but it never really established it. So while myself and many others might not have been, you know, in favor of Lester keeping the offensive coordinator job after what was a really kind of disgusting second half of the season, just when you thought the first half couldn't have gone any worse in terms of the offense, it did. So I think that, you know, giving him an entire offseason, allowing us to see what happens when he has full prep and his, you know, quote-unquote, his system is in, I need to see things on the field, and I hope that this year we see, you know, a lot more of what's actually going to happen, even in the spring game, than we did last year when everyone was talking a lot about 80 plays a game and all we saw were bubble screens. I mean, I get you don't want to give away the secret sauce in spring for the opposition, but I think at the same time, given the position this team's in, you know, coming off a 3-9 season, with the coaching staff really on the hot seat, I think you need to show us at least something. It doesn't need to be the script, but it needs to be at least the outline, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's difficult because I totally get not wanting to give any kind of information, but you're not, you know, a team's never going to totally down what another team does with just spring game film or whatever they read on the internet. And this fan base really could use something to grasp onto. And, you know, there's only so much you can do with the spring game, but at least having an exciting showing and having some points on the board and plays that are interesting and seem to have some kind of cohesion and go at least a little way in terms of getting people excited throughout the summer. The spring game really hasn't been utilized to the team's advantage in a couple of years, I feel like. So while, you know, you don't want to put yourself at a competitive disadvantage, we're opening, I believe we opened the game with the FBS game, right? Like, we have a pretty solid first 2 weeks. We have, we're playing at Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have Rhode Island and Wake to start. You know, those two teams shouldn't be ones that you're overly worried about self-sabotage in terms of showing too much of the spring game. And then after those two games are over, you know, everyone else is going to have film on you anyway. You're not – Syracuse isn't keeping things in the locked away in the closet and waiting to unleash them on LSU. Like, the team is – you know, Les Miles is going to know what the team looks like and what he needs to worry about. So do what you can to get people jazzed up for this season, because there's not a lot of recent success from 2014 that's going to do it.
Yeah, I think you brought up something that I hadn't really even, I guess, brought up myself, which was, yeah, this team hasn't really used the spring game correctly. And I don't know that there's ever a hard and fast, you know, set of rules around, you know, how to use the spring game correctly. I think it really depends on the situation your team's in with your personnel and your fan base. And I think, you know, this is one of those situations where you need to pull out all the stops and really show people something new and something different, especially when we've seen kind of 2 years of diminishing returns on the offensive end. You know, last year, offensive line was already kind of dinged up in spring, so we didn't really get to see that group, and it was actually a harbinger for things to come, sadly. This year, you know, I don't want to you know, really kill these guys in spring, especially on the offensive line, when we're going to be breaking in a lot of new faces. But that said, I think we need to see some capabilities. And most importantly to me, a real recommitment to the running game, especially given the backs that we have on the roster. I mean, this, even without Herb Phillips lining up, you know, at the halfback position, I think that's going to be an interesting fold, at least to see how him and Grizzly and Ashton Broyles will get along in the slot, when you could argue that opportunities for the three of them and Steve Ishmael and others are going to be limited if we have Hunt throwing to tight ends a ton.
Yeah, I'm also not totally convinced that we don't see Herb Phillips get some runs out of the backfield. I wouldn't be shocked if he ends up playing both. I just think the team is probably looking to find a way to get him the most possible touches and get him in space. And the shift to, you know, we've seen guys who, you know, like Tavon Austin at West Virginia was a receiver, but he rushed at a, you know, he rushed a fair amount. So I don't know. I think with a guy like that, the team isn't going to move him to give him the ball less. So I'm not overly concerned about that change of position, although it's a little strange considering he was probably the most exciting back on the team last year.
No, I think that's a good call. I guess wrapping up kind of the spring stuff, defensively, do you see any of the incoming freshmen ready to jump in right away? I know on offense that there's a good possibility that a lot of these freshmen are able to get them burned. But defensively, I think is where we were really going to see maybe not more freshmen, but I think where we could see a lot more impact in terms of freshmen, if only because we do need a lot of new faces and a lot of new blood quickly to prove that this group, that this, you know, Dave, it has been strong despite program struggles, you know, is going to stay at that high level. And I know I teased it out, you know, about a week or two ago on the blog, but I do see this defense potentially being even better if we even see a slight uptick from the secondary.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the secondary goes, I think Marquise Blair is probably the most likely guy to make an impact just because how much we've heard about him. He's 6'3", 180, so he kind of has that Darrell Estridge-type size already. I don't think he would start, but I wouldn't be shocked to see him come in for some, you know, the staff formation packages and the nickel packages that we have, especially if there's a, you know, big receivers line up against. I think Jake Picard on the line probably has the best chance of playing right away just because he's already, you know, a pretty good frame and you know, is another really highly touted player. And we've seen this team be pretty effective when using a lot of different looks on the defensive line and different rushers to kind of do the whole pass rush by committee rather than having one dominant guy. And then this new guy, Ted Taylor, I don't know much about him. I haven't even had a chance to watch any of his film, but I don't think Syracuse would take him on if he didn't think he could play right away. There's not a lot of sense in bringing a community college kid on if he can't contribute. So I'm going to believe in the staff on this one and say hopefully he's a guy who can at least give them some depth and some quality snaps on defense. Although, admittedly, I don't know much about him.
Fair. And for me, I think that there's a lot of options. I'd love to see Jake Picard be able to jump in and make some impact early. But I think him and guys like Shai Cullen are ones that we're going to see later on in their careers. I mean, not later, but obviously, I think 2016 is a better target for those guys. But I think in general, Marquise Blair, to me, seems like a perfect kind of candidate to jump in, make a real impact. I mean, admittedly, I was looking through for another article on Wednesday, just kind of some real impact freshman performances from players in football and basketball, so that was far-reaching. But the one thing I noticed was there really wasn't a ton of impact from freshmen on the defensive end outside of Dyshon Davis and his freshman year. So I think I'd like to see another name added to that list. I think Blair, again, given how much of a disaster the secondary has been, could really be could be that guy. And without getting into all the willy won't he qualify conversation.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are concerns about that, but I like to err on the side of, hey, let's believe in the kid to qualify before, unless we hear something really concrete. So as far as we know, he's going to be here. So I don't love, you know, even if it's not unfair, I don't love, like, overly worrying about the kid if there isn't anything to really worry about. Because then it kind of, like, I feel like it almost attaches a stigma to him. So hopefully he'll be here. We haven't heard anything about him not being here. And if he isn't, you know, hopefully this test can get him to Milford or wherever and hang on to him. It's about a 50-50 shot, it seems like, when they don't qualify. So, but if that happens, that'll be we'll get to that bridge when we have to, I guess.
Agreed. And yeah, for what it's worth, like, anybody who ever has a qualifying question, you know, you always want them to succeed and you always want them to win. And right now, you know, we don't know. I think Blair, as it stands, is part of the class, and I'm happy to have him. And I hope that remains the case.
It's funny, because like, Blair's the one that they're... Oh, sorry. I was just saying there's like, Blair's the one where there's, like, the most talk about it. But it seems like every year there's, like, one or two, and half the time it's not anyone where there were whispers about, so... You know, it happens to every program. It's just one of those things. But hopefully everyone makes it. I think last year didn't everyone. I think everyone, aside from Dawson, obviously has completely different issues. But I'm pretty sure everyone else qualified too. So maybe we'll have another run of luck here with in terms of grades.
Agreed. Because before we jump into some bracketology stuff, I don't know if you saw this article on Deadspin earlier. From Norm MacDonald's Twitter that Eddie Murphy was supposed to play Bill Cosby in Celebrity Jeopardy and reneged at the last second.
Oh, Eddie.
Why?
I saw whispers about that, but I haven't read the whole. I know Norm's been on like a giant tear, and I haven't had a chance to dive into that. Hopefully he doesn't delete it before everyone gets to read it, because I know Norm does do that occasionally. But that would have been brilliant. I really enjoyed the whole SNL 40. I'm a big SNL fan, so that was a really fun watch. But yeah, that could have been epic. And I guess that kind of explains why Eddie Murphy's role was so kind of a little disappointing overall.
Yeah, I think that's probably the weirdest element for me of the entire thing, is that if you're going to bring Eddie Murphy back, you kind of need to have him make an impact. I mean, it just kind of rang true of what Eddie's done or hasn't done, you know, this last probably 5 to 7 years at the very least. And that's, again, putting it conservatively. As a comedian and as an actor, considering how funny he was, maybe he still is, It's very odd to see him kind of, you know, put in the shadows by a lot of other people who, frankly, while they might not have the same raw talent, were just able to completely, again, overshadow him on that program. And that's not even getting into people who were equally as talented, and there's like Chris Rock, who absolutely killed it, even in their minimal time on stage.
Yeah, and I've, you know, all the stuff I've read and listened to about the special since it aired on Saturday, it does seem like they were kind of, you know, kowtowing to whatever Eddie wanted to do, and it turned out he didn't really want to do much. He was just kind of happy to, or just kind of willing to show up. So I don't know how much, you know, they could have convinced him to do, and maybe that was like the one big thing, and he just fell, you know, didn't feel comfortable with it at the end. And obviously they have Keenan who they can plug in and do anything. So they had a contingency plan. But it is disappointing that his his part of the night was so minimal when it was such a big deal that he was going to finally make it and be a part of the whole SNL community, like so many others have embraced.
No, I agree. It's funny now looking at, you know, someone like, because one of the biggest, I think, underlying issues for SNL has always been, you know, how it involves African-American comedians, especially African-American women. And it was interesting to see when some of the, you know, the four most notable on the show, as far as tenure goes, you know, Tim Meadows, Chris Rock, Eddie Murphy, and Keenan, to see Eddie Murphy be the least impactful on the night was definitely surprising to me.
Yeah, even Darren Morris got to do the News of the World, so even he had more jokes at least than Eddie Murphy. But yeah, it was I don't know. I guess it was like one of those things where you'd rather have him be there at all than not show up, because then it's kind of an awkward hole in the history of the show. But definitely could have gotten more out of him when everyone else seemed pretty game to do whatever.
Agreed. All right, so that was our off-topic tangent tonight, and actually, I feel like it worked. I feel like enough people care.
I mean, 23 point whatever million people watch, so I hope there's some crossover in the SNL fan, Syracuse fan community. I have to imagine there's a little bit at least.
I mean, I would imagine, based on the fact that there is nothing to do in Syracuse on a Saturday night, most winter.
It hasn't been any better. I mean, it's been a little... It hasn't been to the negatives down here in New York, but it hasn't been terribly better. And then I went to Charlotte this weekend, and it was in the 30s the whole weekend down there. So can't escape it on the East Coast.
Yeah. It was 78 in Vegas this weekend, and it's going to be hanging around the 70s pretty much for forever over here. Which, yeah, it's pretty nice. Except we're in a drought, so if that makes everybody feel better, so be it.
Yep, I'm just hoping that this winter does end. I kind of feel like we're in a... At this point, I feel like we're almost in like a Game of Thrones situation where it's going to last like 7 years.
I mean, based on forecasts, it's, everybody's getting nailed again this weekend, so could be the case. I'm sure it'll go away. It just might take a while.
Yeah, this has been, I don't know. I feel like up in Syracuse, I never really had a huge problem with it, but this winter has just been absolutely brutal in terms of just sheer coldness. So, and then I know it's been really bad up there, so I hope everyone who's heating, lighting the fires and listening to our fine podcast as they try to brave the rest of this winter, where we feel for you. John doesn't really feel for you. John hates you, but I feel for you. Pull that hurt too.
I feel for you. I just can't empathize. But yeah. On a lighter note, bracketology.
Oh right, that was what we were gonna do. I knew I had a link to pull up, and I just totally forgot what it was.
Yeah, so bracketology. You could take two different tacks, I think, when you're looking at this without Syracuse involved. You could either get really angry about it and make picks despite, or the way I do it is you could make picks despite and make picks just to laugh at what could possibly go down. Last week we saw me pick 10 seeds and 8 seeds to get to the Elite Eight. So this week, perhaps something else as surprising.
Yeah, I'm going to pick UL Monroe to beat Kentucky, so take that.
There you go. 16-1, what up?
That would be the greatest result in history.
I'm going to be honest, I hate that people, that Louisville is continually tossed in the same bracket as Kentucky, but I actually think that Butler, Kentucky is a nightmare for the Wildcats.
I actually think West Virginia could give them some trouble. Obviously, like, every time I think West Virginia is becoming, like, really legitimate, they go and lose to Baylor by, like, 30. But they've looked really good on some, you know, on a night-to-night basis. And then Michigan State at the 9, like, Michigan State's not very good this year. The fact they just crushed Michigan the other night doesn't mean much. Michigan's pretty bad. But you never want to see Michigan State in the NCAA tournament.
No. No, I completely agree with that. And I agree with the West Virginia thing. I mean, I saw them play really well against Kansas. I also don't buy Kansas, but I'll entertain it here. West Virginia looked good there, and I just think they're not sure what they are. I don't think as for as good as the Big 12 is right now, I think the Big 12 is the Big 10 without Wisconsin, basically, in terms of consistency, in terms of quality. I think the teams are too evenly matched. I don't think any of them are necessarily elite. I think most of the teams in the conference played laughable non-conference schedules, and that has kind of given us a ton of teams, all very good and all tournament worthy, and I don't want to take away from them in that regard. But I think that what you're going to see come tournament time is going to be a couple of those teams that get higher seeds than they may deserve. Some others might get lower. I mean, West Virginia, I think they're better than an 8, to be honest, and that could really hurt Kentucky down the line, especially when you think being on the same line as Kentucky means that if you're an 8, that you're the worst 8.
Yeah. I kind of agree with your Big 12 viewpoint. I think there are better teams across the board than the Big 10 has this year, but with the Wisconsin thing is definitely true. I don't think there's a dominant Big 12 team. I think there are a lot of good teams. But Wisconsin is so far and away the best team in the Big 10 at this point that, you know, they've kind of made that conference stand out, where the rest of the conference is probably a little down from where it's been, as opposed to the Big 12, which Kansas is still a 2 seed somehow. Kansas is just, they're decent, but I just am totally unimpressed by them. I think Notre Dame's a better team. I would probably flip-flop those two. But there is something to having a good reputation. And I think that's – and there's just – the 2-line's pretty weak overall. I think after Wisconsin, you know, Nova's had some bad losses. Arizona has probably underachieved a bit, and Kansas isn't that great. So, you know, this is kind of a weird year in college basketball where usually you have at least, like, 2 or 3 good lines of teams, and this year you have, like, 1, maybe 3/4 of 1.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think Duke could very well lose tonight, and that'll, I think, knock them off that top line. I never buy the Zags as a top 4 seed. I just don't think they're there. The records might not put it this way, but I do think that I'd be completely okay with Kentucky, Virginia, Wisconsin, and Utah as your 4 1 seeds. And then I'd put Virginia down in the south. I'd put Wisconsin probably put Wisconsin over in the Midwest. I'd put Kentucky over in the east. And then I put Utah in the west. And I think you have a pretty solid 1, 2, 3, 4 that, again, while the records might not always bear it out, I think those are probably your 4 best teams. And to me, they're probably the 4 best bets to make the Final 4 before you get into bracket talk.
Yeah, and there are some other teams like I get hung up on Iowa State. I just feel like they're so talented. And then every, like, 2 weeks, I feel like every 2 or 3 weeks, they have, like, a really bad loss. But that's a team that I feel like is pretty good value for in terms of, like, a weird team making the Final 4. I think they're back up in the 3-line here, according to what Lenardi has. But every couple of weeks, they just seem to have just this really terrible loss in the Big 12 that they shouldn't have. And then they just work their way back up. And that's like the one team in the Big 12 that I think has the talent to really break out and be like the team of that conference. And they're strangely consistent because like the last couple of years they've been good and they've been a pretty good bet. They just haven't been as good as Kansas. And now I feel like they should be better and they can't quite get over it.
Yeah, I completely feel you there. And I think that looking at least the bracket that Joe Lenardi breaks down, this their lot here actually isn't bad. I mean, SMU, Villanova, Indiana, sure, but I still think Iowa State's probably the best team in the bottom half of that East bracket, and I think that they do stand a pretty good chance to beat a Virginia or a Maryland coming out of the top of the East. So not to skip ahead or, I guess, jump the shark a little bit here, but I mean, I would bet on Virginia, Iowa State in the East. In this, if you're looking at this region, I'd bet on them in the East Regional Final with Iowa State.
Yeah, I just don't trust Villanova enough. And maybe part of that, the fact that Syracuse should have beat Villanova, and we, you know, I think Syracuse is okay, but I don't think we're all that great. And we've seen Villanova have some really bad losses this year. They just seem stuck to that two line, and I don't know. I think the team has a lot of talent, but I'm not sold on them. And I think the Big East is a decent league, but I think that it's been a little overrated this year just because there aren't a lot of other great leagues in college basketball either.
Right. Well, I think that's pretty accurate. And again, like, it's weird. I don't like these seeds for the most part. I don't think anybody does. And I don't know if you read Mark Titus's, Power 12 today, and he was talking about the mock selection process from the other day that the media went through. And the big issue was that, you know, he said Notre Dame almost got knocked off the top 16 slots for an Oklahoma team that has bad losses, that has more losses. And people were contradicting themselves and pretty much saying, oh, well, you know, this team has quality wins, and that's what put them ahead of Notre Dame, but Notre Dame has quality wins. Like, well, this team doesn't have any bad losses. Well, neither does Notre Dame. Like, it was interesting to see, like, him go to bat, and him not being, like, a Notre Dame apologist at all, him going to bat for the Fighting Irish, really, and wondering why, in God's name, people were considering, you know, again, putting Notre Dame as the worst four seed and potentially trying to make a case for them to drop down to a five. And if they did, I'll be honest, they'd be one of the more dangerous five seeds I can recollect. And whoever faced them and was in there, whatever one was in their bracket, I'd say would be on upset watch, despite the fact that that Mike Brave's teams are well documented as, you know, tourney chokers.
Yeah, and that, we like to make fun of teams like that who do so poorly in the tournament, but, like, that shouldn't have any impact on how a team is seeded another year. It's totally unfair to do that. And Notre Dame, I could see them losing early, but I could also, I mean, would anyone be shocked if Jerry and Durant went on, like, a Kemba Walker run? I wouldn't. Dude's awesome.
Neither would I. I think that's spot on. I guess with Notre Dame in mind, looking at the Midwest, and I think we kind of chatted through the East already, I want to pick Kentucky to lose, but I'm not going to. I'm going to go against my better judgment and go with Kentucky and Notre Dame in the Midwest.
Yeah. I'm not going to pick against Kentucky this early, although I do think West Virginia could beat them. I think Butler could beat them on a really good day. Louisville could, but I'm souring on them, especially because Kentucky probably has a little bit of a mental edge on them. Yep. In the South, or in the bottom part of that region, not the South region, obviously Notre Dame is strong. I also kind of like Arkansas. I think they've kind of flown under the radar, and they play a tough style for people who don't see it often, that 40 minutes of hell.
But UCLA UCLA and Illinois, not Illinois actually as much as UCLA, but if they have to face a UCLA team coming off a play-in game, that does seem like a dangerous game for them.
That's true. UCLA is playing a little better as of late. They kind of just snuck into the tournament field, you know, when they were kind of left for dead a couple weeks ago. But any of those teams, I think this is an interesting region. Even Temple is kind of sneaky, and as much as I hate to say it, Georgetown, they occasionally lose in dramatic fashion, but Devontae Smith-Rivera is a really good guard, and he could beat teams by himself, kind of like Jerry and Grant can, although not as often. So Kansas I'm just not a fan of. But there's a lot of teams I think that should do some damage. I think Notre Dame is probably the safest bet just because we've probably seen them more than we've seen a lot of these other teams. But I don't know. I could see a lot of these guys coming, stepping up and challenging and then making for an interesting Sweet 16 game for Kentucky. early late game for Kentucky, I guess.
Yeah. All right, so down to the South. I think Duke can get past Ole Miss and Iowa. That's not going to be an issue. I think Baylor presents problems. Like it's weird to me because we say this about Duke so many times, and it holds true yet again. Duke gets a gift with the way that this bracket sets up, if it actually sets up this way. And I think Duke could easily get a pass to the Elite Eight, where they very likely face Utah, and a very dangerous Utah team that I think would, in fact, beat them.
Yeah. The other team up in the top part of that bracket I think is really interesting is Iona. I could see Iona putting up like a 90 points against a Baylor defense that doesn't always know what it's doing in the zone. And then that's just a really fun team to watch, and especially for those who missed the days where college basketball had points. Baylor's also huge, and you know, they could stop all over them. But that'd be a really interesting clash of styles, I think, in that 12-5. But overall, I think this is a pretty decent bet for Duke. Obviously, they're playing in Charlotte because Duke always plays, you know, near home for the first round. That's just mandated. Ole Miss, I think, is decent, but I don't know. They've looked decent, especially in that game that they really shouldn't be Kentucky in. But I'm never going to be sold on these SEC middling teams to do a lot of damage. Iowa's been up and down. Yeah, I kind of agree with Duke from the top. In the bottom, I like Utah a lot. I think Oklahoma State's coming on. But I think Wisconsin's probably the most talented team. And I think Wisconsin and Duke in a rematch should be really interesting. Obviously, Duke handled them at the Kohl Center, which is impressive. But I don't know. Wisconsin has had, you know, a really nice season. They're going to win the Big Ten regular season, probably going away. But I don't know. I just really like that team, how it's built for March. We saw it last year. So I'd be rooting for them to knock off Duke, I think. But it's tough because we've already seen those two teams play, and Duke won pretty handily.
Yeah, I mean, admittedly, like, I went with Utah, but I could easily go with Wisconsin. I think with this bracket is dangerous for everyone involved is I do really think that Duke, Utah, and Wisconsin are probably three of the top six teams in the country. And to me, that's what's a little aggravating, seeing this, like just seeing this bracket laid out this way, is that they would have to kind of knock each other off before the Final Four.
Yeah. Utah, I think, is kind of an enigma for people because they had a little bit of hype going into the season, but more like a top 20 team. So now I think the Pac-12 has been kind of a weird year, league this year, and I don't think people quite know how to process them.
Yeah, and I think, too, you know, in Pac-12 football, Oregon keeps people, and when USC's good, keeps people sticking around and watching those games and staying up late. When it comes to Pac-12 basketball, you know, unless it's a weekend game with Arizona, or UCLA is a top 10 team. Yeah, like you just everyone's going to bed before these games wrap, and just, you know, no one's really paying attention. I guess that's, you know, UCLA really is the key there. Arizona's a draw, but at the end of the day, the Bruins are what's going to get national audiences tuning in to the Pac-12, and only if other squads in the conference are actually you know, living up to some standards. So that's the difficult thing here is, you know, for me, I also have a different perspective than most because I'm watching most of these games over dinner. While others, it's really like kind of an afterthought. But yeah, I do hope that come Selection Sunday, those teams are split up a little bit.
Yeah, it's also tough because, like, Pac-12 football, you know, not everyone will stay up for it, but those of us who do, I watch about as much Pac-12 as I do ACC at this point. You know what you're getting. You know you're getting a lot of points. You know you see Washington State, Cal, and it's not – they're not good teams, but you can see records be broken because the two teams just play offense. Pac-12 basketball, you just don't have that kind of, like, cohesive league identity like the football league does. If it was, like, a run-and-gun league where teams are dropping 80, 90 points every game, it'd be a little different. But it doesn't seem a whole lot different than any other college basketball league in terms of the pace of play and the style. It's just kind of a different, you know, it's an interesting mixture of teams, but none of them have really a super attractive identity aside from Arizona when it's good.
Yeah, I'd agree there. I think league identity is an interesting concept in college basketball. In football, again, like you said, there are very clear league identities that ebb and flow, but for the most part, you know what you're getting when you're watching every league. With basketball, there isn't necessarily – I mean, the league identity for the ACC is largely low-scoring defense, except for the fact that, you know, Notre Dame scores a lot, and Duke scores a lot, and North Carolina scores a lot, and those are, like, three of the four or five best teams in the conference. Ohio State and Wisconsin and the rest of the Big Ten teams, all of them, you know, incredibly defense-focused, and but at the same time, there's plenty of teams in the conference that don't necessarily play defense, and anytime you see a Rutgers box score, you're going to see that that's readily apparent. I think when you look at basketball, it's much, much different. I think the only time I've been able to clearly point to a league identity in basketball top to bottom is really the old Big East, obviously, of just a rough and tumble, you know, kind of punch you in the mouth league that every single team delivered the same type of performance every night.
I feel like it was the identities were more easily definable a couple of years ago, back when we had the old Big East, which was just a behemoth. The ACC was more of the up-tempo league, while the Big Ten was, you know, kind of the slog that probably isn't as fair now because I feel like the leagues have balanced out. Now I think the Big 12 probably has the best reputation in terms of, like, fun play. The SEC is just kind of, like, boring. It's just Kentucky and see if the field can beat them.
Well, it's low quality.
Yeah, it's just not great play. You have, like, I feel like the SEC basketball right now is, like, you have Kentucky, who's awesome, and then you have a bunch of teams trying to beat Kentucky, giving their best shot, and you have, like, one dude who will drop, like, 25 and put a stare into them while his teammates are just useless.
Right.
And the Pac-12 is kind of a mystery league for most of us out here. It doesn't have, like, even the slight cohesion of, like, the Big 12, where the Big 12, you know, these teams don't play a ton of defense, and at least the games are probably more fun than your average, you know, Wake Forest-Miami game.
No, I think that's spot on. I mean, that's actually something I hadn't even put together before now, but definitely a good thing to discuss and really kind of point to is maybe why the Pac-12 needs some help. Brings us a nice segue to our last bracket, the West. Just like last time, I'm picking San Diego State to head to the Elite Eight. The Zags, VCU, Oklahoma, SDSU plays enough defense that I think that the matchups fall right. This looks really good for them. I like Oklahoma a lot, but Valpo's kind of scary for them on that 13 line. I think down in the second half of the bracket, again, like Arizona looks like the clear best team, but at the same time, like if you told me Providence went on some miracle run and got to the Elite Eight, I wouldn't be shocked. I'm going to go with North Carolina. But that said, I don't think there's much separating them from Arizona or Providence.
Yeah, I like VCU a lot. Obviously, we've seen what they can do in the tournament. I think they're coming on pretty strong. I'm not bold in Gonzaga. San Diego State, I'd normally be all about, but I feel like they don't have that, you know, Xavier Thames type go-to guy. I know they still lock people down on defense, but I still think you need a score that you can rely on. Admittedly, I haven't seen them as much as I have in years past. Oklahoma is a weird one. Like, I feel like they're kind of like all these other Big 12 teams where it seems like they're ready to kind of grab hold of the conference and then they lose to, like, TCU or Kansas State or something. So I like VCU just because they play, you know, that habit defense that teams that just drives people crazy. The bottom is really interesting. Like you said, Providence has some interesting players. UNC is obviously having a really nice performance in Duke right now, and it looks like they might pull the upset here. Even Ohio State, you know, they're not a great team, but Dinwiddie is a good coach. They have some good players, and D'Angelo Russell might be my favorite player to watch in the country. I could see him leading that team to an Elite Eight, a Sweet 16, just kind of on his back.
No, that's spot on. All right, I think that's a good place to end it. Unless you had anything else to say, Dan, I think we covered a lot of tournament. We covered a lot of spring practice, and nice to be having one of these post game podcasts after a win.
It was unlike
normal.
It was a nice change. I feel like we've had a lot of losses in these post game podcasts, and this is definitely a good one. Big win for the team, and I think it will help rejuvenate the fan base a little bit and get us, you know, excited for the season, how the season wraps up, and hopefully next year we'll, you know, be rearing ready to go back to the tournament. All things knock on wood in terms of the NCAA and everything.
I concur. All right. So with that, that was Dan. I'm John. Thanks for tuning in to Troy Noons is an Absolute podcast. Be sure to subscribe, rate us, review us on Blog Talk, on iTunes, and we will see you next week. Go Orange.
Go Orange.